everybody. David Donaldson here with another episode of Entrepreneurial Impact. And today I have Keith Barrett from Vesta Settlements with us for a second time as we continue to talk about lawsuits and settlements. Keith, welcome back to Entrepreneurial Impact.
Dave, great to see you. Thanks so much for having me.
For those of us that might have missed the first episode, why don't you give everybody a little bit of introduction about who you are, where you're from, and why you're the guy to talk to about?
Well, my name is Keith Barrett. I am the founder of Vesta Settlements and a former practicing litigator. I hope I'm the guy to be talking to about it. Been trying to follow this pretty closely and stay abreast of what's going on. So obviously, unless you've been living under a rock in the real estate community, we kind of know what's going on with the suits and now the proposed settlement. So hopefully we'll have a good convo.
Well, now, while we joke about that, the unfortunate sad truth of that is because we're in some of the situation that we're in, there's a lot of agents that are living under a rock, and there may be some agents out there licensed that have no idea what's actually happening in the landscape of real estate right now.
Indeed.
File that under sad but true.
Yes. Yes. Agreed.
So last time we spoke, right, we had first kind of had the impact of the lawsuit hitting us saying, okay, this is what's going to happen. We have found so-and-so guilty. And in that time, certain organizations have settled. And then the big drop after that was NAR. And then NAR settled. And so now there's a lot of curiosity, insecurity, misinformation, gosh forbid, misinformation that has hit the airwaves in the news, go figure, about what's actually happening and what's not actually happening. So let's kind of talk about what actually happened and what did NAR agree to?
Yeah. So here's what actually happened. What actually happened was on March 15th, NAR executed a settlement agreement. It's over 100 pages long with a class of plaintiffs, which were sellers, right? Represented by multiple parties. But this was a class settlement where NAR agreed to certain things, which I'll tick off very high level in a moment.
Sure.
And in consideration for what NAR agreed to, there was a legal release given by the class of plaintiffs, which was basically every seller who had sold a home through a broker listed on the MLS over a period between the last 5 and 7 years. So just think about the gravity of that. That's every seller across the United States was essentially, you know, grouped together as part of this national class action settlement. So every single seller who used a broker over the last 5 to 7 years listed in the MLS is now agreeing to this release. And the consideration was a couple things. One, a payment of money, $418 million to be exact, to be paid over 3 years, I believe. Two, an agreement to adopt new practices and agree to certain prohibited practices going forward on a going forward basis. Three, an agreement of what's called cooperation because there are certain defendants that were not released as part of the settlement agreement where lawsuits would potentially continue to move forward. And the released parties had to agree to cooperate with the plaintiff's counsel in further prosecuting the case against defendants that were not released. And then lastly, the rest of the settlement agreement was mostly procedures and timelines and things of that nature. So I think for you know, your audience, you know, probably the most important, because the easy stuff is, right, payment of money, agreement to cooperate, procedures and structures going forward. But the most important thing here is, okay, what are these new practices? What are the new procedures? You know, what exactly are we talking about here as far as, you know, what NAR agreed to as part of this settlement?
Right. And that's an interesting concept, right? We settled. Settlement doesn't necessarily mean guilty, but we've settled. NAR settled.
Yeah.
And there are brokerages that fall under the settlement. There are brokerages that do not fall underneath that settlement. Okay. I think that $2 billion in sales volume is the threshold for that. If I
have
that correct, right?
So the released parties in the settlement agreement basically as follows: National Association of Realtors and all state and local associations, 1 million+ realtors who are part of the release and are released parties. We have association-owned MLSs that are released parties, and we have brokers that did an average over the last 4 years, average sales volume of less than $2 billion over the last four-year period of time. They are all released as well. So you're correct. If you're a brokerage and your average annual sales volume was over $2 billion, you're not released by this settlement. And if you're an MLS that is not association owned, you are also not released by the settlement. But what the settlement did do is it created an avenue of release for those groups that were not covered by the release. So specifically, if you were a brokerage, let me back that up. The sales volume was based on 2022, so it wasn't the average annual sales volume. If you were a brokerage that did over $2 billion in 2022, you were not released. But you can get a release, and the release formula for the brokerage is that if you add up your average four-year sales volume, okay, and then you multiply that number by 25 basis points, so 0.0025%. If you're a brokerage and you agree to pay that amount of money, you will get released under this agreement. And then for the MLSs, you just take the number of subscribers of the MLS and multiply that times 100. And if the MLSs agree to pay that figure, you will get a release as well as part of the MLS. And then the settlement agreement also recognizes that those figures might be too expensive, might be too much money, like company-ending money. And so you can opt to enter into a mediation if you want. But there's all time frames on this. They're not leaving it open-ended. You know, the plaintiffs weren't stupid. They're putting a time frame. They're creating some pressure on these entities that weren't otherwise released to make a decision or potentially be sued going forward and have the class lawsuit continue.
So if I'm a real estate agent, what do I need to know?
Yeah. If you're a real estate agent, you're in a good spot. You know, I've heard a lot of real estate agents complain about the National Association of Realtors and about the settlement. But the truth is that the National Association of Realtors is agreeing to pay $418 million. And as a real estate agent individually, you're getting released from liability. You basically have that cloud removed from your head going forward. And so you really don't have to worry.
For now.
Going forward. Well,
for now.
So the settlement has not been approved. That's one thing, right? The settlement is a proposed settlement. Last I saw, we're probably looking at finalization at some point in August. There are parties that are able to, you know, file briefs with the court in opposition if they want. So, for example, I wouldn't be surprised. So for your listeners, like don't get all bent out of shape, but I wouldn't be surprised if the Department of Justice maybe files, you know, in this particular case and opposes the settlement. But by most measures, from what I'm hearing, it is anticipated that the judge in Missouri is going to approve this settlement agreement.
Okay. So we understand that there's still some moving parts. When I say for now, really what I'm kind of alluding to is it's not standard business practices have to change. There are things locally that we should have been doing all along that when you look at the surface of the lawsuit going, buyer representation is a thing. It has been for quite some time. However, we as realtors did not do what we were supposed to do. So if we're not doing what we're supposed to do going forward, you do potentially put yourself at risk. It's kind of what I'm alluding to. You, your
yes.
brokerage, your organization.
Yes. So Dave, it's a great point. Yep.
Right. So you have to get back into truly understanding where do you fall right? Now, we really can kind of look at this in a couple different ways. There are three different contracts, essentially, that are going to take place. It's going to be a listing contract, buyer broker agreement contract, and the mutual agreement contract that is a sales contract. They've been there to a degree, but they're different. And as to what we're going to find out is who compensates whom is really some of the changes, or how that compensation is reached and shared is really kind of some of the unknown. We have some ideas that we could tie it into that about how, but that's where we're going to see some of the initial changes, right? And this is why I think in the future we could allude to some buyer countersuing, because I think buyers are the ones that are kind of going to short out of stick going forward a little bit. So let's talk about what that looks like.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's a great point. So let's talk about what that looks like. So the one thing that I would point out initially is for us here in Virginia, we were actually pretty lucky, because going all the way back to 2012, the Virginia agency statutes went through a pretty significant revision. Mm-hmm. And one of those revisions was that all brokerage agreements must be in writing. So here in Virginia, we have required for the last 12 years that doesn't matter whether you're on the buy side or the list side, if you are entering into an agency relationship with a buyer or seller, you must have a written brokerage agreement. That agreement has to be in writing. Now, for the majority of the country, that has not been true.
Yeah, I was actually surprised how many states or jurisdictions did not have a buyer broker agreement. I came here from Arizona, so that preexisted. When I moved here in 12, there was kind of people were like in shock, and I'm like, this is common practice for me. So yeah. It was interesting to watch that adjustment change and not change, but to find out through this lawsuit now that we still were a very small percentage of the community that had that. I was surprised by that.
That's right. That's right. And so there are brokers and agents in other parts of the country that are really freaking out, because that alone is just a really big change for them, just that piece alone. But for us, we've been dealing with that now for 12 years. So not a huge deal. Then the other part of what you said is important, which is, you know, we have a buyer broker agreement, we have the listing agreement, and then we have the sales contract between the seller and the buyer. And Dave, you were alluding to so how do payments, what is that going to look like now going forward about, you know, broker fees and how this is going to happen. And so the settlement agreement essentially lays out three avenues of potential payment. One would be the traditional sense, the one that we've been used to, which is what we call cooperative compensation. The settlement agreement doesn't forbid that. What it does forbid is advertising it on the MLS or any MLS-supported platform. Okay. But cooperative compensation can still happen. So really what it's going to look like if that, and I don't think that's going to be the preferred path, but I'm just laying out what the settlement agreement says.
Absolutely.
What that is going to look like is a little messier, because we're not going to have this central database where all that information is just shared and equally available in the form of a unconditional unilateral offer of compensation. That's not going to be the case anymore. So if you and I were working on a deal and you were the listing broker and I was the selling agent, you know, I might just have to call you up. Hey, Dave, you know, I got a buyer interested. Is there any cooperative compensation being offered or anything like that? So it might be as simple as a phone call where we're going to have a discussion about that. There are other possible avenues to get that information out. But generally speaking, the settlement agreement says you can't advertise it on the MLS or any MLS supported platform, which would be Zillow, CoStar, I mean, Homes.com, all of those are
screaming. That Zillow conversation touring can last for another day.
Oh, yeah, right. That's a whole other
issue. Right, that's their end around, right?
Yes, that's a whole other issue. So you have that. So that's one avenue. The second avenue of compensation is seller agreed compensation directly to the buyer broker. So not from the listing broker to the buyer broker, but directly from the seller to the buyer broker. That also cannot be advertised. So they treat that the same way as cooperative compensation. You can't advertise that, but the seller can offer compensation to the cooperating broker. And the third avenue of compensation would be a seller concession toward the buyer's closing costs, of which the buyer's agent's fee is a part of that. And so the seller can offer a concession. So those are the three main avenues that the settlement agreement leaves open for buyer agent compensation.
Now, I want to pause here, right? Because I also want to reflect back on the last 12 years of the buyer broker agreement's existence from a documentation standpoint in our world here in Virginia, and why this is such a heartache for a lot of people. And I want to talk about the value proposition, the conversations that the agents need to have that probably haven't been had, or how that's actually been presented in the past and when, right? So the buyer broker agreement in its nature was an upfront agreement. I meet you, we have a conversation, we decide to work together, right? We agree on compensation in that agreement. And I think too many people have kind of backed us, don't worry about this, I'll get it from over here. There's zero sum, you're not gonna have to worry about this type of thing. And we probably didn't talk through it well enough about what it actually meant. And two, when did we actually get that signed? Way too many people were getting them signed and ratified at the same time we're ratifying a contract.
Yep.
That, I think, is what has opened up to a lot of the scrutiny here and abroad about what this is looking like. So now we actually have to have agents really look at what their offerings are. What do we do as a real estate agent? What do we do that's different, that's not just service offerings, to establish my value, to determine that this compensation that I'm asking for in a buyer broker agreement, which now has to be upfront without knowing what I might get from the other side, right? So now you're actually getting into an agreement between two parties before you even go show property, because in order to open up a door, I have to have this documented agreement in place that may or may not be offset by some offering on the other side.
That's right. That's right.
So how do we get through to agents and go, look, while nothing's changed, everything's changed in your mind about how you present and the conversations that you have to have with your consumers?
Yeah. So starting more technically, and it's a good point about that buyer broker agreement. There's always been questions on timing on that. And I think that's a really good point to address. The settlement agreement says that it's got to be signed before showing a home. But the settlement agreement also leaves room for the fact that there may be state laws that speak to that, and that the settlement agreement can't really override those state laws.
Okay.
Other than the state laws that currently don't exist about the requirement to have an agreement in writing in the first place. Now, our state here in Virginia, there's a guidance document. So for those listeners that are curious and that want more information on this, there's a guidance document at the Real Estate Board website that literally talks about the necessity of brokerage agreements and also specifically addresses the timing, as you talked about, of the execution of those agreements. And the hard part about that document is that they say that it's based on the intent of the consumer. In other words, if it is the intent of the consumer to engage you in licensed activity as a buyer agent, then it's at that point in time that you must get that buyer broker agreement signed. So just as you said, executing that in the moment of contract ratification is no bueno. It would have had to have been done way before that to be compliant with the law. But more importantly, and I think the main point that you're getting at is, like you said, with respect to the buyer broker agreement, nothing has changed, but everything has changed. You know, our buyer broker agreement has clearly stated, you know, fees and compensation. We have a whole paragraph in there. But I think that the verbiage, the language, the discussion around that probably hasn't been as robust or transparent as it should have been. Plus, we're going to see some changes to the buyer broker agreement forms as a result
Absolutely.
Of it. We're going to see them July 1, okay?
And we're not going to touch on the theoreticals, but we kind of have an idea of what they might look like, but we'll see when we actually see, right?
That's right. We're going to see changes. So, for example, like the settlement agreement says now, by way of example, that when you set your compensation, when you agree to that with your buyer, you cannot be paid any more than that.
That's right.
From any source. So if you agree on 2% and somehow the seller is offering 3%, you're limited to 2%.
Yep.
Now, we can discuss whether you are able to go back and mutually agree to a revision to your buyer broker agreement with your client. I mean, I believe that generally speaking, people are free to contract with one another and they can modify their contractual agreements. But in the absence of that, you are limited to what you agree to as far as Absolutely. Your compensation. You can't accept. So there's one example of something that we know has to change.
What would fall in the same category would be any builder bonuses.
Yes. Yes, that's exactly right. So we have issues like that that we need to address in our forms. That said, I think what you're getting at, and I think what a lot of the talk around this is, and it's not really legal in nature, but it's really business in nature, is everyone's talking about value proposition, particularly as a buyer agent. It's like, okay, generally speaking, I don't want to be overgeneralized, but generally speaking, I think most agents and realtors approached their meetings with sellers differently than they approached their presentation and meetings with buyers. And the general consensus, and I'm mostly parroting what other people have said, but I'll take it a level deeper, is that we now need to be approaching buyers with the same vigor and the same preparation that we do if we're going for a listing presentation, for example. What I find interesting, though, is that everyone's talking about value proposition, but I don't think enough people are talking about what exactly is that. And I think that agents really need to be thinking deeply about what that means for them, because there's no blanket, rule. If everyone had the same value proposition, then you have none. You don't have any value proposition. I think agents need to determine for themselves exactly what their value proposition is. And if I were to put myself in the shoes of a real estate agent, particularly on the buyer side, I think my value proposition would be formed around the concept or the principle that for most people, a real estate transaction is a time-consuming, complicated process. And I think agents probably take for granted the knowledge that they have in their minds about how to navigate a real estate transaction and everything that goes into that, and they take it for granted. And I think that they shouldn't. I think that they really need to be thinking about, and let me give you a quick example. I taught this in one of my classes. I would ask your audience to think about how many buyers do you think know that the seller is required to give them a resale certificate, an HOA disclosure package, and that once they get it, they have a right of cancellation, and that they can mutually agree to extend that right of cancellation by up to an additional 4 days for a total of 7 days on top of the original 3. And how many buyers know that they can order an update to that resale certificate? And how many buyers know that even if they get an incomplete package, that 3-day cancellation right doesn't stop for anything? Even if the package is incomplete, they still have to exercise their right to cancel within the required time frame. Like, how many buyers know that? And the answer is zero. Zero buyers know the answer to all those questions, but most agents know that. And that's just one little sliver of navigating a real estate transaction. So
I think that's the question. The question is, you say most. I question that.
Well, perhaps I'm being generous, but maybe you're getting at another issue with respect to this settlement, that this settlement and the business going forward is going to separate the wheat from the chaff.
Absolutely.
Right? It's going to separate the agents that over the years have been educating themselves, going to classes, cutting their teeth, getting the experience, truly understanding what their value proposition is even before this happened, from those agents that are, kind of part-timing it and not investing in their business and not investing in their education. So maybe it works both ways. The agents that don't know that, then you're right, they're not going to be able to express a value proposition then, right? Yeah, they're just door openers.
Since this really hit us and we knew change was coming, and I look at, as I travel around the region and I talk to different offices and I look what's happening, Those that are going to survive are the those that are hitting this head on and are championing education, championing awareness, tramping like, do our people know what happened, know what's happening, and how to present themselves, stay above board going forward. That's what has to happen, right? So if I'm an agent looking at my brokerage, my business, my team, my individual ownership, I have to ask myself, do I know what's going on? Do I know enough about what's going on? Am I talking to the right people? Am I listening to the right podcast about the information that's taking place out there? And am I informed enough to go out and have that value conversation to deliver, this is what's happening, this is what's real, and this is how the business works, and this is why I'm the person for you.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. You know, you have to understand what your value proposition is, and you know, you're right. For those agents that don't understand, for example, the process that I just described,
yep,
they're going to have a much harder time forming their value proposition.
And then there are going to be an unfortunate amount of people that are going to devalue themselves into oblivion.
Well, so that's the other interesting thing, Dave, and that's a good point. You know, what I think we're going to see here in the immediate aftermath of the final approval of this settlement is messiness for some time, right? Things are going to be messy for a while. Yeah. And you're going to see different business models. You're going to see people that maybe just adopt a race to the bottom and just say, forget value proposition. I'm a total commodity. And so I'll just compete on price.
Well, there's always been a class of business for that anyways, right?
Yeah. 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 It was always possible. It was always possible. But that, you know, I suppose we don't want to look backward, but that's
no.
One of the reasons why this antitrust lawsuit, you know, came in the first place. But
well, this is why I say you need to look around at who you're with, because who you're with matters.
100%. 100%. But that all the more reason to establish that value proposition, because I think you're exactly right. You're not only going to have to compete with other realtors and brokerage models that are looking for that value proposition, that are justifying their professional fees, but you're likely also going to have to compete with the ones that go in the other direction, which is, I'm not really offering the same value, but I'll compete on price and I'll do these things for X price. And it's going to be a lot less than, you know, the 2 or 3% that, you know, this other person is charging. And so there's going to be a messy middle here. There's going to be this transition period where we're all trying to figure this out. It's going to be frustrating, but I have a lot of faith and hope that we will reach the other side of that, and we will see a coalescing around certain practices, compensation and otherwise.
I completely agree, right? And that's why I kind of focus on education, and I look to NAR for the good that they can do, right? About, hey, what's our barrier of entry look like? How are we holding people accountable? How are our brokerages holding their agents accountable to be the practitioners, right, and the business owners that they can and should be?
Yes.
Now, there will always be gray, and that's where I'm scared to death. Like, this is not one of those times to play in the gray. And I hear agents already like, well, we'll do this. Let's not play in the gray until we figure out what the real is. Like, do we know what the black and white is? Let's not worry about the gray right now. The gray is a problematic area to live in until we get through that initial hurdle. Now, I kind of touched on earlier, but like, hey, I think there's kind of like a springboard coming back on the other side, because while I can look at it as a business owner of a real estate and a real estate practitioner and say, hey, there's some challenges. I need to look at how I'm running my business and how I set expectations. The buyers, I truly are the one who are getting the short end of the stick here, right? What is that going to look like for them? Like, there's a lot, like, we have to educate them, but there are certain, we'll take VA right off the top, right? That's a whole different animal. We're talking about contribution and we're talking about limitations. Now, I know some people come out and said FHA or conventional, there'll be some limitations about what's looked at and what's not looked at. These are some things that probably won't necessarily be settled by August.
Might not be, particularly on the VA side. That my guess is it more likely than not will not be resolved by August. But yes, those are all, first of all, I couldn't agree more. Like, let's get the black and white right first, right? And then we'll get to these gray areas. The good news is we do have certain progress that's been made, and I'm going to go out on a limb here. I normally don't like people that make predictions because the truth is nobody really knows. But we have enough people making predictions that when the cards unfold, some of them are bound to be right just because we get so many predictions and they look like geniuses. But the fact of the matter is at the time they predicted it, they really didn't know. So here I am about to stick my foot in my mouth.
Hold on, let me snip this one out. Go ahead.
Here we go. Is this being recorded? So my prediction, you know, as it relates to what you were talking about, you know, FHA compensation issues, all that stuff. My prediction is that industry is going to coalesce around compensation that is likely going to flow in the direction of the seller offering compensation directly to the buyer broker. That's my prediction. And the reason for that prediction is this. Cooperative compensation from the listing broker to the buyer broker just seems very inefficient now because it can't be done on the MLS. It's got to be done on a one-on-one basis. And there's still also, even though I know the forms are going to change, there's still some kind of opaqueness around that around a seller understanding exactly how cooperative compensation works.
Yeah.
Secondly, as it relates to a seller concession, and when I say seller concession, I mean a seller payment directly to the buyer, like a credit to the buyer. That is subject to the lender's interested party contribution limits on the loan. And so you have to get into, you know, the whole underwriting thing, how much money is being put down. As you were talking about, Dave, what type of loan program is it? What loan type is it? And therefore, how much is going to be allowed? And you're going to have to know that prior to contract ratification because the seller's offering that concession to the buyer. And so the prickly part about that is everyone is relying on that once that happens. And if the lender comes back and says, oops, right, we made a mistake. We thought we could allow 6%. We can only allow 2 or 3. Then people are going to get upset about that. And that's going to be a problem. But the GSEs have come out and have confirmed, and this is several weeks ago now, that a seller payment directly to the buyer broker is not subject to the interested party contribution limits.
Right.
And it is also much cleaner than going with the traditional cooperative compensation from the listing broker to the buyer broker. So my prediction right now is that the easiest flow of the river, even though it's going to be messy, is that the way that compensation is going to be structured as it relates to transactions that have loans on them in particular is going to be an agreement probably in the residential real estate contract itself, where the seller is agreeing to credit some amount of money directly to the buyer broker. We do have some questions around that, though, just digging a layer deeper on that, because, of course, the buyer broker is not a party to the residential real estate contract.
Right.
And so the question becomes is, you know, is a seller agreement in that contract to pay the buyer broker? Like, how is that enforceable? Is the buyer broker a third-party beneficiary? Are we going to update the contract to maybe have an area where the buyer broker will actually initial that part of the contract to confirm that compensation? So there's some details to be worked out there, but my guess is that's the direction it's going. It's the path of least resistance. It's transparent, and it is not subject to the lender's interested party contribution limits.
All right. Well, listen, this has been another vibrant conversation. I appreciate it. I think there's probably a part three in our future for this. But if you were to part one place, if you were to tell agents, hey, check yourself, what would you tell them to do right now while we're in transition?
Stay calm. No, seriously. Stay calm. Be prepared for some uncertainty. Some messiness, it's going to happen, but know that, as you said, if you're serious about your business and you understand the industry, the nature of a transaction, the cadence of a transaction, all the little detail that goes into it, you are confident that you either have or can develop a solid value proposition, then as you said earlier, Dave, like you're going to be okay. You are going to be fine. It's going to be fine. And I would also say this, and I mean this very wholeheartedly. Given what I do for a living, I am perfectly capable of handling a real estate transaction all by myself. I actually don't need a real estate agent to either buy or sell. But here's the truth. If I were to buy or sell, I would hire a real estate agent. I absolutely would. And the reason for that is because, and this is an old expression from law school, a lawyer who represents himself has a fool for a client.
There you go.
And I think a buyer or a seller that chooses to represent themselves has a fool for a client. Because as soon as you get involved in your own deal, you lose 30 IQ points right off the bat. You are not the objective, rational person that you thought you were. And I want that objective, rational person on my side.
Lose the emotional objectivity and you just can't focus. And you're going to focus on the wrong things.
That's right. I want the David Donaldson who, because it's not his own deal, is going to maintain his rationality, his objectivity, his expertise, and advise me every step of the way.
You heard it here, folks. The lawyer says he's going to hire me. So I'm in. Listen, Keith, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you very, very much. And for everybody listening, if you missed the first episode, go back a couple of weeks, check out our first conversation with Keith when this first broke down, and check back in a couple of weeks from now, probably August, September, so we can kind of reassess where we're at. Keith, thanks. You're always a valued resource. Have a great day.
David, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
All right, everybody.